microphones when you're speaking.
Recording has started and guys are ready to go.
Okay, can my boss okay? Call please.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Brinker.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Start off with a minute.
I think we have minutes.
Minutes.
Oh, yeah, minute.
Move to approve the minutes from April 15th.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Great, thank you. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
I'll wait for a moment as this launches. As this is going, these numbers are through April 30th. And interesting, because now we're getting into that period of time where comparability is going to be really volatile. We're into the shutdown period in 2020. We're not completely open yet here in 2021. We've got a lot more open than we did. Activity is pretty good. What's going to be interesting, I'll try and weave in a little bit of basis points from 2018 and 2019 for some more comparability as we talk about the numbers. We do continue to see a good amount of activity. We highlighted on a few headwinds that are going to potentially start affecting us come the season after Memorial Day, and those headwinds are still pretty real. Supply chain continues to be a real challenge for us. We cannot complete the purchase of our golf carts, for example, because of the inventory shortage that's out there. Construction costs are haven't directly impacted us yet, but they're coming. Lumber's up 400%. Steel is up significantly. Availability is starting to be something we're having to manage a lot more closely. The P&D team is really working hard to keep us on track and to work with our partners on the contracting side to make sure we can get materials on time. So we talk with P&D about things like looking at anything that's a vertical project versus on the ground and maybe deferring on the vertical. If it uses timber, if it uses steel, now might not be the best time to do it. But ground materials, concrete, asphalt, excavation is still pretty fairly priced, so we can continue to move with those. As we jump into this, we can start by looking at the property tax numbers. So don't get excited about this, what looks like a $2.4 million favorable variance from where we were at this point last year. Last year was the anomaly year. Last year, we were behind $2 million all the way into November, if you'll recall, due to a difference in timing of collections. We're actually right on par with 2018 and 2019. So this is just a timing difference. It's not additional funds. Looking at the grant numbers, this is being driven specifically by three grants. This is for Tiger, CMAC, and NOACA relative to Brighton Park and Red Line Greenway. So the timing of those collections are coming in at this point now, which is why this looks like it's a real healthy number. We've spent these funds. These are reimbursement based, so it's not like this is additional revenue for us. It's making us whole for what we had spent prior. And then on the charges for services line, if we look at this versus 2019, which is a much more comparable basis of comparison, we're about $200,000 ahead of where we were in 2019, to give you some perspective, because it looks like we're $1.2 million ahead of where we were last year. And if you can see by looking at just the April activity, 1.7 of that came in April because we're in that period of shutdown now. So it was a meaningful impact, but not indicative. We're normalizing in that regard, at least through this point. So from a total revenue perspective, this puts us about 8.3 million over last year, 6 million of which comes from the grants. We're about $6 million over 2018 and 2019, again, because of that 5.5 million, almost 6 million that you're seeing here on the grant side. So all of the other revenue activity is fairly normalized through April relative to 2018 and 2019. I just want to point out, when we look at the salaries and benefits, there were three payrolls in April of 21. There were two payrolls in April of 2020. May saw three payrolls in 2020. So what we're going to see next month is this flip-flop, where it looks like we're unfavorable to the tune of $1.8 million. That'll flip next month. Timing difference only. Looking at our total operational expenditures, we actually very consistent with where we were in 2018. We are about $1 million less spend than 2019. And that's due to the fact that we still have some reduced operations. We still have a controlled spend in place because of those headwinds that I mentioned when we got started. We're keeping an eye on those, and we'll know more as we get into the real summer season. The operating surplus is about $7 million higher than it was in 2018 and 2019. But again, $6 million of that is due to the timing on the grants. So again, we're super consistent with where we were in 18 and 19 from a perspective through April. On the capital expenditure side, significant activity through April this year. We're $2.8 million more spend than where we were at this point last year. We're $3.8 million more than where we were in 2019, but we're real comparable to where we were in 2018. And again, this is really driven by, number one, we've had good weather, and number two, we've had significant projects going on. We've seen the progress that we're making on Wendy Park Bridge, Whiskey Island Connector, and several other projects that we have going on. Or that we've completed already. So that activity has been nice and strong. This puts us from a net surplus perspective at about 5.9 million more than last year. Again, 5.5 of it you can see is the grant timing. It's about 3.5 more than 19, about 5 million more than 2018. So if we normalize that grant component, we're slightly behind where we were in 19 and almost even with where we were in 18. So a lot of consistency across those years that you can consider a normalized base. Jumping to the zoo, we actually have a strong start to the zoo, about $100,000 more of gross revenue for the zoo than 2019 and about $480,000 more than 2018. It does signal a good start. A lot of this is reflective of the fact that we've had some dry weather. Temperatures have been a little bit cool up until this week, but it's been dry and we're still at that point in the year where there's not a lot of competition, frankly. But as other things open up, we're likely going to see some impact to that as people start to travel again, as they start to spend entertainment dollars in other areas. Cedar Point just opened up this past weekend. So that was their inaugural push. We may start to see some impact of that. So those factors are real for us, and we'll keep an eye on them. When we look at the total operating expenses, total operational expenditures from the zoo standpoint, we are about $90,000 less than 2018 and about $420,000 less than 2019. This is across a host of categories, a little bit less than the minor computer equipment spend, program supplies, janitorial supplies, property maintenance supplies, HVAC supplies. Those are all timing items. This is again an example of where we're being judicious and watching budget closely until we get a good feel for how the season is going to go and what opportunities we're going to have. The only non-timing item, and if we look at 2020, we did have a deposit for the dinosaur exhibit in 2020 that was about $74,000 that we don't have in 2021. That was a one-year event, so that since that's not coming back, we don't have that deposit again. On the operating subsidy side, we're about $300,000 less subsidy than 2019 and about $400,000 less subsidy than 2018. Again, can't really compare to 2020 because we're in the period of shutdown in 2020 versus now. So it's not a good baseline. And then when we jump down to our capital expenditures, you can see here we've got significantly less capital expenditures from a timing perspective through April. Obviously, as the year goes on, this number will continue to vacillate back and forth a little bit based on timing. So that puts our net subsidy position currently at about $4 million. At this point in 2019, it was 5.2, and it was also about 5.3 in 2018. So real consistent between those 2 years based on that activity in 2021. You can see how this is normalizing even at our divisional levels. Jumping to golf, this is really interesting. So strong start, we're up about $637,000. From where we were in 2020. Now we can compare to 2020 for golf because golf was up and running, with the exception of we had delayed starts in a couple of our courses. Little Met and Mastic started later in the season. So that's part of the reason for this. The other thing to point out is we're starting to recognize some of the impact of owning carts versus leasing carts. So as we get rounds played, that helps us a little bit as well. But what's interesting is our rounds played are up about almost 90% through April, and April was a real significant bump. You can see here that $395,000 more activity came through in April alone than it did last year. So We'll see how this gets impacted during the course of the season as other courses open up and as entertainment dollars, you know, start to get spread out a little bit.
So how does the golf cart delay affect any of this year?
When we own a cart, we don't pay.
No. The ones.
Oh, the golf cart delay.
We haven't gotten.
We're still going to be paying the lease revenue share on that component. So it'll affect us during the course of the season. It'll affect us in the five-digit range, tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of dollars that we could capture if we own it. Because we're down to, well, I have to think of the number of how many carts we have left to buy. It's under.
About 50.
About 50. I was going to say, I thought it was going to be a little bit over 40, so under 50. So we have a lot of the fleet already, which is why we're seeing some of that trickle through.
But that basic change, the delta between rental and owning the fleet in larger dollars has been what?
That's a great question. I have to get back to you on the answer on that for sure. I can pull what we paid in the rental last year on that.
But it's a chunk of money.
Generally, it's two-thirds roughly. So if we have the ownership of it, we're getting 100% of the revenue. If we're doing a revenue share, we're getting about two-thirds of the revenue. But I can put real dollars to that and let you know what that ends up being.
Just wondering what the overall impact was.
In the revenue share model, we're not leasing it then, we're renting it, right?
Yeah, well, yes. So basically, we have an agreement, right? So we are renting.
We can't buy, can't exercise a buy option.
There is not a buy option. It is strictly a rental agreement. That's a better way to put it. The buy component is a schedule, the five-year schedule of buy down that we had, and this was supposed to be the final year of it. It'll be pending inventory availability on whether we can actually complete that this year. But it's been a good move for us.
Yeah.
When we look at the operating expenses through April, we're about $82,000 higher than where we were last year after adjusting for the additional payroll. So obviously it looks like there's a significant difference here, but don't forget that $212,000 is a timing item. And then when we trickle that on through to the operating surplus or operating subsidy side, excuse me, we are about $327,000 less subsidy than this point last year. So we've reduced it by almost half. And this is similar to when we compare to 2019. We're a lot more on pace with 2019 so far this year. 2019 was a strong year. So it's been interesting to watch this incremental activity growth that we've seen on the golf side. When we jump down to the net after capital expenditures, we're about $370,000 less subsidy than last year after the CapEx. Capital spending, though, will continue to increase as the summer goes on. If we can get the carts, we will put that money into the capital equipment. We are doing the cart paths right now out at Big Met, so we'll start to see that spend come through in the May financials and subsequent. We have some maintenance facility improvements that need to be done maintenance-wise, maintenance on the maintenance facilities, if you will. So we will see some more capital expenditures coming through. In 2019, we had about $1 million more capital at this point. That was when we were finishing up Seneca and the irrigation system and some other improvements. So capital can obviously create a lot of volatility when we're trying to do baseline comparison. On a per course basis, this becomes a little bit less meaningful this year when we look at year over year for some of our operations. Again, Little Met was opened later. So with that affects our comparability. As we get into the season, it'll be more applicable for us because we'll be full-fledged with golf. Again, this is the one division that last year was able to operate sort of what I would say normally. But you can see here on a course-by-course basis how we're trending so far. And again, green indicates revenue and operating surplus or subsidy is better. Both those indicators are better. Yellow means one of those indicators are better. And if it was red, that would mean both indicators are worse. Jumping to enterprise, this has
Bill,
been.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
With respect to the zoo and golfing, is the hiring of people going to limit our revenue at all? So are we impacted on the hiring side and either of those two operations?
I'm gonna answer that with more words than yes or no. The zoo, I think the revenue impact at the zoo is going to be on the capacity side more than the hiring side. The quality of the experience at the zoo might be affected. We may not be able to do quite as much with grounds maintenance. Perhaps we're not doing quite as much cleanup or emptying cans as quickly if we don't have some of our seasonal help. But the zoo team has done a lot of adjusting to be able to handle it operationally. On the revenue side of the zoo, you know, we've still up to this point been operating at probably no better than 50% capacity in a lot of the days, just for distancing. Now that some of the orders are going to fully lift as of June 2nd, we may be able to see more throughput, and then that would then obviously put us in a better position from a revenue perspective. On the golf side, candidly, we made the adjustments last year without seasonals. We're going to have to make the adjustments this year without seasonals. So I don't expect golf to be largely affected by the lack of seasonal hiring in terms of revenue. Again, it'll be how well can we maintain the courses? How well can we keep up with our typical standards?
Without hiring seasonals, are we burning out our staff? Just curious, are they having trouble, are the golfing side having trouble hiring people?
Yes. I mean, I think the last I heard, we were at 39 hired out of 400 seasonals, roughly. So you're talking about 10% of the normal workload. So it is very stressful. Golf, zoo operations, park operations, it's been very stressful on those teams. The managers and the staff in those respective areas have been working incredibly hard to try and keep up. Burnout is a risk. I mean, obviously, we communicate with everybody as much as possible to make sure we're doing our best to address that. But team's working really hard. So the seasonal impact is real.
Yeah.
When we look at the enterprise results, we're up about $60,000 over 2019 and up about $120,000 over 2018. This is going to change unfavorably as we get into the season. You know, Merwin's is a good example. This is where the seasonal hiring really does directly affect the revenue side. We don't have the seasonals, we can't open up. If we can't provide an experience that's reasonably at our level of quality, it's just not worth doing it and have people disappointed. So we know that it's going to have some impact on the revenue side if we can't get some seasonals in at a couple of the locations. But you can see, we'll look at by location. You can see that on the dock rental side, we're doing pretty well. And we'll talk about that other category when we look at per location as well. That's driven by ledge pool being open this year and by parking having more activity downtown, and therefore our lots getting more revenue throughput this year than last. Jumping to the operational expenses, we are actually very consistent with 2019 and 2018 through April. Again, difficult to compare relative to 2020, and there's an additional payroll in there compared to 2020. So 18 and 19 are the better baselines. And then when we look at the operating surplus, we're up about $187,000 relative to 2020, but we're very comparable to 2019, where we were at $239,000, and 2018, where we were at $274,000. So sitting at 263 right now, again, we're looking back at some comparability with 18 and 19. We've normalized a little bit in that regard. And then after capital expenditures, not a whole lot of change, minimal cap investment at this point at these locations. Speaking of these locations, gray area indicates where we have not opened up yet. You can see the goose eggs on the revenue side to indicate that. When we look at the other areas, again, green, overperformance in terms of revenue and operating subsidy or surplus versus prior period of last year. Merwin's is still experiencing a lot of that throughput that came in early in the year from Rivergate Winterfest. But obviously, as we get past Memorial Day and into that summer season, we're going to see that start to flip there. We see a little bit less trepidation at the marinas this year, so more people signing up. A little bit sooner in the year, you can see that coming through in the numbers. Emerald Necklace, that one, we're still doing okay, not quite at the same pace. And that one, if you remember last year, was actually a stronger start last year. Some timing differences. Again, this was, we implemented a contract system at the end of 2019 and into 20 that affected the timing of some of those contracts and when they came in. So this will normalize a bit as we go through the year as well.
And East 55th is open now. It just wasn't previous months this year to give
for the restaurant itself.
Yeah.
Yes, it opened in May.
Okay.
So it was not open through April. So we'll start to see some of that revenue come through in next month's report.
And the beach house is opening soon.
Is it
in the by the weekend?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, good.
It's close. In fact, we just saw the inventory purchases come through in the last couple of check runs. So we'll see those numbers in the May output as well.
Fine. What are we doing to hire more people? Are we trying? Everyone's having the same problem, so it's not. We see it everywhere. Are we doing anything special to attract more people into our various operations, seasonal people?
I mean, I can say we've deployed just about every opportunity between job fairs, between posting at every high school, between personal phone. I mean, we're trying everything we possibly can, but anecdotally, we had two seasonals that had been with us multiple years at Huntington. We were probably paying between $9 and $10 an hour. They got offered $14 at Subway and they both left. And so the competition for that entry-level seasonal job is very tough right now. DoorDash has definitely changed the dynamic of when people want to work. They can work from 11 to 1 and make a fairly good wage, and they can really control their schedule versus the schedule kind of controlling them. And so we're going to have to continue to adjust to the market at that point in time. But golf course operations, you need to be out there, you know, 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the morning, getting the golf course prepared. Zoo needs to get prepared when we're time to open. So, you know, we're time specific to our job. So we're going to continue to do what we can, but it has not been an easy time this year.
Do we raise pay?
We have been raising pay, and it's not necessarily filling the bucket. It's just because I think the inventory or the reposition people just haven't. And I don't necessarily want to say it's related to the $300. I don't exactly know. I don't have a crystal ball as to why. But if you want to be employed, there are plenty of opportunities. I was on 82 between Strongsville and North Royalton, and I counted 20 signs looking for help. And so it's an extreme challenge. People have repositioned themselves for sure.
One issue could possibly be, because this is unique. This is, everyone's basically right now in Ohio, and I don't think this applies to seasonal workers, but if you don't work at all, you're getting the equivalent of $17.50 an hour. That math works out with the 300 and 403. So you're having to compete with that. And because of that, there may be a wisdom in doing something special, because seasonal workers have to re-up every year. You could put some sort of a temporary increase on it that would not reflect
until June 26th.
Well, I don't think you can do quite that fine, but you could do something now that would apply for wouldn't apply for next year. Follow what I mean? We can do that; other people can't. But I think hiring people is an absolutely critical problem now. It's epidemic. I've never seen it anywhere near this bad.
Yeah, and I think it's what you're going to see across the board, and I can speak to what we're doing here. We're going to try to open as much as we can, but there'll be more limited hours. And instead of running 7 days a week, we might run Thursday through Sunday. And they may be limited hours for lunchtime and evening time. Guarding right now lifeguards is a huge challenge for us, and not just us, but the Kalaharis, the Cedar Points, the Summit Metro Park. So our goal, again, is to keep them open and guarded as much as we possibly can with the hours and the people that we have available.
Yeah. Well, I know we're doing our best, but looking at turning over rocks and thinking of other approaches.
We do cross-reference with some others. We talk with Cedar Fair, for example. You know, they offered a $500 signing bonus to their seasonal workers to get them on staff, and they are still woefully understaffed. So much so that they're not opening a lot of their food concession areas, and the ones that are open have 2-hour waits because they're focusing operationally on who they have on the rise. So so even with that kind of a one-time incentive, it's not drawing people in, at least not to the level that they had hoped. So it's creativity is a must, but it's everyone's hunting for a small population that is interested in coming out and doing it. So it's been a real challenge for us.
Yeah.
Just moving quickly on the last slide here, you can see this is where Ledge Lake and parking that I referred to earlier, Ledge Lake being open this year, has had some impact, positive impact. And then the parking with a little bit more vibrancy downtown by our lots, we're getting some more utilization. We've talked about the chalet that now is all pretty much wound down. The numbers are pretty much through this, so I'll start marking that gray as we go forward. But again, we had capacity restraints on that. They did a wonderful job. They handled as much volume as safely possible, but we had to time the constituency going through, so that affected us. But that's largely where we're at. So those headwinds that we keep talking about are real. If we, I mean, just in rough numbers, if you're talking about, if we are talking about having to increase to a rate of a 50% increase for seasonals per hour, we've budgeted, I think 2019, our budget was roughly $6 or $6.1 million for seasonals. So you're talking about adding another $3 million on top of that. That's a huge chunk. If we are brought into that, bringing it up to a $15+ an hour rate for the seasonal. So that's a tough one to swallow.
It's a tough one, but you know, have to, I mean, everyone's got to look ahead, because you're not going to get people at the same price you did.
Absolutely true. Any other questions?
Oh, one other comment I had, Brian, I know you're doing this, but I'm amazed at how cheap it is to put lumber through a sawmill compared to buying it.
We are certainly working at it for sure with our drying room over at Rocky River. Ralph and his team certainly use lumber a lot. Again, I think, you know, Bill did say it best that we, our goal is to, you know, finish the flat, anything that's horizontal. And if we need to start to go vertical, we really need to look at the costs that are associated with it. With proposed zoo project coming on board, we're going to be very, very mindful of the costs.
Yeah. Well, I think our next is bring in.
All right, let's bring forward the very first action item, swearing in of Police Captain Kenneth D. Shabitzer. If he can please step forward and take the oath.
Appropriate, what's wrong?
Yes, wherever you would like.
I state your name.
I, Ken Shabitzer.
Solemnly swear or affirm.
Solemnly swear or affirm.
That I will support the Constitution.
That I will support the Constitution.
And laws of the United States of America.
Laws of the United States of America.
Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio.
And the Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio.
Natural Park.
Laws and regulations.
And I will discharge my duties to the best of my ability.
And I will discharge my duties to the best of my ability.
Of the officer of captain, which I've been appointed.
The office of captain in which I've been appointed.
I will faithfully carry out and implement policies.
Faithfully carry out and implement the policies.
Enumerated in the instructions given to me by the, given to me.
Enumerated by the instructions given to me.
By the Board of Park, by the Board of Park Commissioners of the Cleveland Metro Park District.
By the Board of Park Commissioners of the Cleveland.
Excellent. Thank you.
As Ken has presented his captain's badge, and Ken joined us in 2002 under retired Chief James Whitley Jr. He served as Ranger, Traffic Unit Officer, Field Training Officer, Sergeant, Dive Team Coordinator, and Lieutenant. So he has also been instrumental in Cleveland Metro Parks Police Department's CALEA accreditation. So again, congratulations, not only once, but twice through the accreditation, and congratulations on your promotion, Ken. You're welcome. The recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 9 to appoint Kenneth D. Shabitzer as full-time police captain for Cleveland Metro Parks.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next, we will swear in our three new police officers. If Sabrina, Bradley, and Corey could please step into the room and please step forward.
Oh, I like the back door.
Sing one.
Wow. So we'll be, Brian, just repeat after me. I state your name. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution and laws of the United States of America. Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio. Regulations of the Metro Park. And I will discharge my duties to the best of my ability of the office of patrol officer, which I have been appointed. I will faithfully carry out and implement policies enumerated, instructions given to me by the Board of Port of Park Commissioners of the Cleveland.
You did that on purpose.
Oh, yes, and now I will.
As each one of you signs your paperwork and has presented your badge, Sabrina comes to us from the park, to the Park District from Baldwin Wallace University. She served at campus security. She has served as an auxiliary field staff person. She's now with the Cleveland Metro Parks Park District, which is absolutely fantastic. Her OPATA certification came from Cuyahoga Community College. Bradley Nipakny came to us from the City of Cleveland Police Department. He's currently, he currently is attending Cleveland State University. He received his associate's degree from Cuyahoga Community College in 2018, and his OPATA certification from the Cleveland Police Academy. Corey Reese is coming to us from the Five Rivers Park District. It's always nice to bring someone up here from another park district where he served as ranger since 2018. He has also served as a ranger for Miami County Park District and Lorain County Metro Parks. A great background in parks. He has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from Youngstown State, and we would like to welcome all three of our newest police officers. The recommended action appointing all three to their positions falls on the top portion of page 10.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Welcome.
We'll continue with the rest of our work now, so you need to stay if you don't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Brian, you're on.
Yes. The next action item is the 2021 budget adjustment number 5.
Thank you, Brian. Budget adjustment number 5 is for $3,987,099. $3 million is one single donation. $3.72 million are new restricted monies that have come into us for various projects. $115,000 is existed restricted funds that we had not previously appropriated. That makes up about 3.8 out of that 3.9 that you see here. An explanation of the adjustments by category can be found on pages 40 to 42. The recommendation is that the Board of Park Commissioners approves this budget adjustment number 5 for the $3,987,099 as detailed on those pages.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next action item is the then and now certificates, authorization to draw warrants of payment of purchase. Per Ohio Revised Code, we are required within 30 days to certify these purchases. The recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 11 to certify the then and now certificates.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Next action item is the resolution exempting Cleveland Metro Parks purchase of $999.99 or less for the chief financial from certification from the chief financial officer. Bill, do you want to just give a quick background on that?
Yeah, so as part of the item above, the then and now certificates, if we ever have an instance where we have an invoice prior to a purchase order, I need to certify that we had the funds at the time of the invoice and we have the funds now to make that purchase under a PO. But in this case, what we're asking for is that for purchases under $1,000, so $999.99, that we don't have to go through that certification process, that it's a de minimis amount, and that we can just go ahead and allow the purchase to occur without the then and now certificate for myself.
How often does that happen? Purchase something without a PO?
It is probably something that happens. We've had now three in the last 30 days. It is periodic. It's not frequent. Sometimes we'll see three in a week. Sometimes we'll see three in a year. So it doesn't have a ton of predictability to it. We're obviously tracking these, but you know, to give you a, for instance, we may have a circumstance where we quickly needed to arrange for the surgery for the tiger cub, or if we're on site and we're getting aggregate and we've PO'd for five loads, and then we determine that we need a sixth, and we're already in the process. Sometimes it's easy to not double check and make sure that extra one hasn't been, and do the change order in time. So operationally, it takes a lot of diligence to make sure that we don't do this. And timing wise, it's not always perfect for us. That's what some once in a while creates these scenarios for us.
But for example, let's take the tiger cub. If that happens, can't someone just ask for a purchase order? Whoever's in charge of that operation, would they have to talk to a financial person at the zoo? Isn't that something that just can happen like that?
That's still not exempted though, correct? Because it's over the thousand.
I'm sorry?
That would still not be.
That's right.
Right, that would not be exempted, that's correct. But what would happen in that case is sometimes budget has to be moved first. So just getting a PO, you can only get a PO or do a PO change order if there's adequate budget. And in the case where we have to do a budget transfer, such as just talking through some of the ones that we do each month, yeah, we may have to do that first before we can get the PO issued.
Okay.
Or the change order to a PO issued to make sure we have adequate funding for it.
Yeah. Cases I've seen, usually it's the friction of the process in getting a purchase order that seems to botch things up the most. But I think it's nice that you're keeping track of exceptions, because that's important.
Arguably, I would say that the purchasing department here is extremely adept, and they do absolutely whatever they need to. Periodically, though, a mistake does happen,
yeah,
and it needs a correction. And we're all human, and we're running 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and there are anomalies that do happen. A surgery for a cat isn't something that we normally do. I think we had one situation where our aquatic biologist has been here 20 plus years and ordered the wrong fish from the wrong company. So, and you can't get the fish back. It wasn't like we could pull them out of the water. So unfortunately, things do happen, and we have to have a mechanism by which to take care of it.
But we track it to see if it creates a trend.
Yeah.
We do. We track it for trending purposes, and we track it for ORC compliance. So, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
Very true.
Recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 12. Just wanted to make sure we explain that.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Next action item is authorization for Cleveland Metro Parks Police Department to enter into an intergovernmental cooperative or mutual aid agreement. This is a continuation. This is now with the Village of Gates Mills. Recommended action falls in the bottom portion of page 12.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is a special services 6576 authorization to enter into a contract for ice skating rink operation with the success of most recently the Winter River Fest down at Merwin's Wharf. Certainly ice skating has been part of Cleveland Metro Parks for years. Last year we did a pilot project and brought in a synthetic sheet of ice, which was met with some positive and then some negative comments. Having said that, we really wanted to bring in a actual sheet of ice, and so we have come up with an opportunity to enter into a revenue share opportunity and a way to control expenses. And so we have we're bringing forward to the board to enter into an agreement with Seaside Ice LLC, doing business as Ice America, for a two-year season concession management agreement through the seasons of 21 through 23.
So our cost on that?
Fixed. Yeah, fixed at 75.
Got a yes. Question?
Yeah,
any bearing upon public square programming?
None. It was interesting because the way the festival was kind of put together, it was really trying to design to be used and outside. Whether the UCI continues, that we see those actually more as complementary because there's more opportunity. There have been conversations relative to Brookside where it used to be done as well. We also used to do more pond skating, Wallace, Hinkley, but you know, it's based on depths and timing and some consistencies and or inconsistencies. So this is a way to really complement the festival at Merwin's, continue the igloo operations there as well. And we've talked about repositioning it to allow a little bit better flow this year.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the resolution and LPA administration agreement for 2022 to 2023 for the Biennium Roadway Improvement Project. We have continued to use this process slash project. We must adopt a resolution for and through for OPRA to administer the funds to Cleveland Metro Parks. ODOT will, you know, do their LPA and follow up with all of the necessary inspections. This is agreeing to accept the funds out of the Roadway Improvement Fund as outlined above, and the agreement resolution and recommended action fall on the top portion of page 15.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the operating agreement amendment between the Cleveland Metro Parks and the Cleveland Zoological Society. We have continued to work with our philanthropic partner at the Zoo Society and very appreciative of being able to raise and continue to put more than $35 million worth of capital, private, public, and corporate support through the zoo through the last number of years. This is essentially cleaning up language relative to the capital projects as we continue to go forward. Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 16.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the resolution authorizing an application for and to the 2021 Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Resolution Program through the Northeast Ohio Area-Wide Coordinating Agency for the Euclid Creek Greenway Phase 3. Sean, anything you'd like to add to this? This is a very complex funding mechanism and being able to put it all together.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning, commissioners. Great to see you. With the Euclid Creek Greenway, it's interesting to be standing here in 2021 talking about 2026, but that's what we have to do if we want to line up the funds. So just like Red Line Greenway, just like Valley Parkway Connector, we applied for those funds and secured them 3, 4, 5 years in advance. So what we're looking at here today specifically is that blue/purple phase 3 that would take us from the Euclid Central Middle School site at the north end of that yellow dash line up to St. Clair. It's just over $1 million to get that approximate mile done. But the great thing is, come 2022, 2023, we hope to be through the Euclid Central Middle School site. Next year, we will make it from the south portion of the map here. Pardon my clicker. We'll be from the south portion of the map all the way up to Euclid, and then we will be taking possession of the Euclid Central Middle School site. We've applied to Clean Ohio for the funding of phase 2. We hope to be successful there, and then today's application is for 79% of the cost of phase 3. The reason it's 79%, because it's an 80-20 program, but if you overmatch, so that's why we're going to 21%, you get more points.
Sean, just a question. So you go through where the yellow line is, through the middle school. Why can't you follow the river and cross?
Homeland security.
What's a?
Homeland security.
There's a big water treatment facility right in the middle of it.
Two very strong reasons why we can't follow Euclid Creek, although we would love to follow Euclid Creek. The CSX railroad track is right here, and the constriction of their bridge over the river is just that. It would be very difficult and costly to get under the bridge or reconstruct that bridge. We've had enough dealings with railroads lately. It's going to be tough enough just to get the track crossing right here. So that is the primary reason, and secondary reason is Cleveland Water Department would prefer that we stay on the Chardon frontage.
But it is off-road.
It is off-road. There is actually a pretty decent setback on what is the west and south side of Chardon.
What's a decent setback?
There is probably 40 feet, if not 50 feet, between the curve.
That's a decent setback.
That's a very decent setback, yes.
But it'll be along Chardon Road, right? Will it be on the road?
It will be, I'll call it the tree lawn. There's a very wide tree lawn.
40 feet off the curb. That's pretty nice.
So it's actually rather comfortable. We've got some.
It's off the curb, not the right of way.
Correct.
Now the big industrial looking site, adjacent to the, what is that?
I'm sorry, Commissioner Moore, are we talking here? So here's Euclid.
Right there.
Okay, that is the Nottingham Water Treatment Plant.
I thought that was on the right.
So this is the Cleveland Water Department's Nottingham Water Treatment Plant. And that's where they actually, this the third intake from the lake.
I understand.
So to get across St. Clair and.
So to get from St. Clair to the lakefront portion of Euclid Creek, you will see in an information item today, we're going to be talking about the raise grant opportunity. And we've been working with City of Cleveland on that alignment. We've got two different routes or choices. And we are hoping that with some additional funding, we can actually lock down the exact path. We'll talk about that in some more detail a little later.
Oh, so I got, this is TV.
Sean, then.
Yes, sir.
It's wrong season.
We're going to be doing immediately is the brown line.
Correct. This will be done by end of 22. Hopefully this also could be done in 22, depending on Clean Ohio timing and funding. And then before you for the action item today is consideration to apply for CMAQ for phase 3 in 2026.
So I just have to ask to be annoying. I mean, eventually, do we come back to some of these crossing points that are in grade to look at alternative, like Euclid Avenue, St. Clair, all of these? Or is it not worth it?
It may be worth it in the future, like we've done it.
Yeah, I'm saying not now.
Granger.
Later.
With the towpath. The good thing is we have a signal right here that the school district left, not to us, to the city of Euclid, but we have a signalized crossing there.
People pay attention to it?
Well, we would hope. That's the law.
It's an actual signal, not just a flashing.
Yeah, it is an actual signal.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, the water treatment plant, that is not a sewage plant. That's a pure water plant.
Correct. It is potable water filtration.
Yeah. What I'm confused about is coming up from University Circle, Baldwin plant, correct? And people, the road is right next to it. And I'm just querying why. Are they just saying no, sort of in a reflexive way or logic behind what they're
doing? We do find that when we do sit down with Cleveland Water, they are very logical and a good partner. I'm not sure what the circumstances are at Baldwin that you're.
I mean, the road is there, but there's no path or anything. It's secure. You can't get on, like, you wouldn't be able to go behind their property at all.
Yeah, it's got a big fence around.
Yeah.
And they've covered.
But you could do that with a trail.
But I'm sure the same is here with Chardon Road. The road is there. We're well off the road, so.
Yeah, I think that's. It's more a question of where you have to cross.
I'm querying. Yeah, the cross is an issue, but how nice it is to go along.
Sure.
I think to your point, though, Commissioner, the pinch point between the railroad and the river is a huge problem, and it's an impediment. We would have to expand that connection significantly at significant cost. And so I think when you look at visibility and opportunity, the conversation with the city in Chardon, I mean, although, you know, we tried to build in the natural realm wherever possible, you still can have flooding events and other events if in the proximate region of the river. But it's a pinch point where it basically goes through, goes around, and
it could always loop back theoretically. Yes. And come across their yard, or I mean, but it's just more hassle than not.
And
or is the crossing ultimately at St. Clair and the expressway driving this route?
It is. We have.
See, I'm not going to let you just ignore this.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have some other potentially costly constrictions at St. Clair, okay, at the next set of railroad tracks. We have to figure out the best way to get over I-90. We could use an existing bridge, but it takes you a little bit to the west.
I understand. Yeah, there's good. That is a nasty intersection.
Oh, yeah, the grade change, everything.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Great discussion and dialogue. Again, this is the board authorizing adoption of the resolution, authorizing us to submit a formal grant application to NOAACA for the statewide CMAC program. The resolution falls in the top portion of page 17.
Move to approve.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yes.
I second first.
I think you second first.
Second, but then I do have a question. Given that this is 2026, how confident are we in our cost estimates?
We actually use a multiplier that is sanctioned by ODOT. I believe in our cost estimate, we have nearly a 15% escalator.
Okay, so contingency.
Well, that's in addition to it.
Okay.
So we have costs as they are today, escalator, then contingency. Because when you look at $1 million for a mile, that really isn't terribly hard to build. You think that's expensive.
Yeah.
But 2026.
Right. Well, that's it. And as Bill mentioned earlier, the cost of all the materials and everything, we have no idea which way it'll go, but okay. Thank you for that. That's really
awesome. The positive is flat work has stayed pretty consistent and actually pretty competitive. It's when the vertical, we've gotten very good pricing on asphalt and concrete most recently.
Yeah.
It's,
I mean, now, but again, now, we're talking for 5 years, so who knows? Okay. Thank you for that.
What the Federal Reserve says, no inflation. So not to worry, the government's on the right.
Yeah, great.
I think we've got a second.
I seconded, yes.
Move the motion.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
The next is the lakefront in the lakefront reservation. This is an authorization to submit a grant application and commit funds. This is affectionately known as NIFWIF, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. This has been part of the Cleveland Harbor Eastern Embayment Resilience Study. It was funded through a $125,000 grant. There's a host of folks that include the City of Cleveland, Port of Cleveland, Ohio Department of Natural Resources, Ohio Department of Transportation, and certainly the Cleveland Metro Parks have been coordinating this. This is another unique opportunity to partner with and submit a grant for in the amount of $985,000 to the National Coastal Resilience Fund. We have agreed our portion of it would be $200,000, $150,000 of cash and $50,000 worth of in-kind. Each partner would be contributing over the 18-month period of time anticipated to occur in January of 2022 to June of 2023. The recommended action falls in the mid portion of page 18.
Can I make? I think this is a great plan. I think our involvement in it is vital. I mean, spark plug that makes it happen. The thing that I'm concerned about here, I don't think anywhere near enough attention given, and I'm not suggesting that we're the ones that haven't been doing it, but there needs to be a tremendous amount of effort made on getting the Corps to not dumping the dredgings lake.
Come to Catawba this summer.
What's that?
Nothing.
But I think we should have some way of plugging in how we're gonna do this, because this is critical to it. The amount of the Corps is gonna come back and they're gonna say, putting a break wall in, they look at the break wall cost per unit of fill that it can absorb. And you know the one along the airport is getting fuller and they wanna make it higher, and that wrecks everything. So I think we've got to get politically involved here very early in the game. And I think, you know, the Metro Park has taken the lead in a lot of these things. You know, you get a lot of involvement with the community. Someone's got to pull the trigger and do the work. And I think in this case, doing the work is getting that whole thing figured out of we shouldn't be dumping heavy metals in the lake. And getting that understood and clearly defined. And I don't know how I don't think we can include that in this bill, but that's gonna cost money. And I think Metro Park maybe is the live pocket that can that early in the game.
As we continue to work through this, those will all be conversations that all of the partners will be having relative to this, you know, the concept of the open versus the confined disposal facilities. Certainly working with City Hall, the Port Authority are going to be extremely important, and certainly the Army Corps of Engineers. So I think just stay tuned as we're kind of working through this, but we are definitely keeping the iron hot on this.
Great.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the zoo event, Cleveland Metro Park Zoo. We're seeking to extend the three-year agreement with Artistic Holiday Design to execute a ticketed winter lighting festival and to continue engaging the community through this wonderful program that goes on during our winter months. We've had very good success with them within the last number of years going through. And so we're looking to extend this agreement. All of the tickets and revenue shares are all delineated on the bottom of page 18 through page 19.
Move to approve.
Second.
Aye.
The next are the tabulation of award bids, RFPs, co-ops, and single sources. There are a number of them that include human resources, zoo grains, topsoil mulch, buried aggregate stone, fuel and heat oil, office refurb for furnishings and workstations for the HR, which is the final renovation of the Edmund building that has taken us almost 10 years. We are now done with that. The single source 6577 Student Conservation Association Summer Youth Trail Crew. That will be going through at our Ohio and Erie Canal location. And then just announced yesterday, the Sourcewell Co-op 6578 Design and Construction in the Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation for the pump track, which has been very well received as a new amenity to Ohio and Erie Canal and Cleveland Metro Parks.
How does the Student Association, how does that process work? Pay a specific amount per hour?
Yeah, we actually contract. It's like an a la carte almost, where you can pick two team leads and then the amount of team members. We've been very specific about vans and opportunities and recruitment and all of those things relative to how we're going to put this program forward. In order to ramp it up as fast as we did, we used the national group. They also have reaches into a few different sponsorship ideas as well. So stay tuned to that, but this is a good step forward to enhance mountain biking and what I call natural surface trails in Cleveland Metro Parks. This was the first dating back to the former administration. We've now got more than 30 miles on, and we're gonna add 2.7, 2.5 to 2.7 miles here. This is a big project.
Okay, good, thanks.
So all of those are on the top portion of page 20.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Approval of vouchers and payroll.
The vouchers listed here totaling $10,305,172.73 have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code. And the recommended action is that the Board of Park Commissioners approves this resolution as listed above.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Public comment.
Okay. Artie on the line, and Artie, you've been unmuted. Please go ahead and test. Not hearing anything from you. Try some of the call-in numbers. Okay, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Now we can hear you. Thank you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, please proceed.
Oh, hello. Okay. Good morning.
Morning.
No question the money poured into improvements at admin, remodeling, which has included extras like big screen TVs and peace ovens, combined with big salaries and generous benefits to make the upper level positions easy to fill. But all that expense has left a lot less for regular employees who sustain and maintain the park. Low salaries, lack of benefits, and seasonal part-time positions have failed to attract applicants. Are naturalists, pardon me, are naturalists and janitors expendable? Shouldn't a nature preschool instructor be worth more than a restaurant supervisor, more than event auxiliary staff? Besides, the ones who keep returning and those who came up through the ranks have a lifetime commitment and know these parks better than anyone. With all the software, hardware, and techno knowledge, expertise, it is an embarrassment that the agenda wasn't available until 24 hours before the meeting. In olden times, they were able to create, print, collate, and mail a similar agenda and have it delivered by the Postal Service by Saturday before the meeting, and do it again 2 weeks later. I would guess that in order to examine it thoroughly, the commissioners were provided it before yesterday. So now we need to build a mountain bike pump track. So much for claiming folks just wanted a quiet bike ride in the woods. Encouraging speed and tricks certainly detracts for the other visitors who hope to dial back in the out-of-doors. I realize the mountain bike community is very good at sounding louder than its numbers, but this will no doubt cause folks to ride faster and take more risks on all Metro Parks trails. Is the EV charging station located at Admin intended just for the new motorcycles? With that facility arriving, there is a great opportunity to get hybrid or electric vehicles for personal use, emphasizing Metro Parks' environmental commitment, some substitutes for all the Jeeps being purchased. And regarding event attendance, I look forward to the Maple Sugar Ring visitation report. It is hard to imagine that the numbers this year surpassed those, pardon me, in the past, when busloads of school kids came in addition to weekend crowds and all this for more days. COVID surely made it tough, which was too bad, as it's always a good way for visitors to experience yet another benefit our forests offer. Thank you.
Marty, I'd like to comment on the bicycle part of what you mean. That is, a pump trail is not a place to go fast. It's just a different experience. And mentioned that mountain bikers have too large a presence at the Metro Park. I'd like you to remember that there's less than one quarter of 1% of our constituency that own horses, and there are about 50% of our constituency that own bikes. So, and there's about 100 miles of horse trails. What are the bike trails? So that's completely lopsided on the side of horses. I see it just looking at the map itself.
Let me just mention, I think Marty mentioned the agenda was posted 24 hours ahead of time. There really is no requirement that we post an agenda this robust. All we have to do is give notice of the meetings, but we've always taken the extra step of posting all this detail with our agenda. And we do that very timely. And it's not just about technology, it's about all the items coming in, and then we have to review it. So we've got a lot going on, and so sometimes it takes us a little bit longer to make sure we review everything, making sure it's accurate. So Marty, I think that's the first time you've complained in my 10 plus years that it was too short of a notice, but we always continue to be diligent in working on posting it very timely ahead of time. And the other thing I'll mention, though, since we're talking about open and transparent government, is we're happy to report that the auditor did finish the review of our public records program. And again, for the second year in a row, the second year of the program at the state of Ohio, Cleveland Metro Parks have scored the highest ranking, which is a 4-star rating. Not only are we complying, but we're adopting almost all of the best practices. And that will be on the website once the auditor updates the 2020 results. And when you look at the 2019 results, only 14% of the public bodies have reached that 4-star status. So we're happy to be in the top of the class in open and transparent government.
Just as we go into our information and briefing items, just a correction, Marty, the charging stations are for two electric vehicles to be used by Cleveland Metro Park staff. And I'm really not sure how executives benefit from a pizza oven in a break room. On that note, we will move into information briefing and policy items. Outdoor Experiences Virtual Learning Initiative. Mary?
All right, thank you very much. Good morning. Thank you, Board of Commissioners, Brian, for having us here this morning. We're very excited to give you an overview of our new and learning initiatives over this past very interesting year. Outdoor Experiences, just are. We are the education arm of Education, Conservation, and Recreation. Our mission is to connect people with nature, outdoor recreation opportunities, and the cultural history of Northeast Ohio. Our team consists of the education side of the parks only, so that is the 5 nature centers through which we program at all 18 reservations, our outdoor recreation team, the youth outdoors and mobile outreach, which work in our underserved population, and our 2 nature preschools. Similar to Bill and his report on finances, we're just kind of letting the 2020 numbers go by. So a relative comparison for us to talk about impact is 2019. In 2019, we had over 7,600 programs, the vast majority of which were free, 214,000 participants in those programs, and over 300,000 visitors to the Nature Center. And then 2020, we don't need to recap what happened, but I would like to start with a little bit of a timeline. Friday, March 13th, very appropriately, was the day that I like to say the world closed down. We all went work from home, the centers closed, our program ceased, but we very quickly pivoted over that weekend, working in collaboration with our marketing team. We came out with a bang on Tuesday, March 17th, with what we are calling the virtual classroom. This is a platform to engage people in real time using Facebook Live. We offered 3 sessions a day, one by the outdoor recreation team, one by the zoo education team, and one by Outdoor Experiences. We had these at set times. We had an amazing response to this. In the over 220 live sessions we had over 6 million impressions and 400,000 engagements. So an engagement is, I liked, I asked a question, I commented. So we were full bore on that really from March through September. I'd like to mention that once we hit May, the vast majority of the Outdoor Experiences team was reassigned to other areas of the park. So they were managing to do all of these along with animal care, some of our other essential business as well. As we moved from the summer and that reassignment back into having the Outdoor Experiences team on board, we realized that we really needed to make that shift into virtual learning to better serve our community. And what we saw right away was this was going to be a big team effort. First and foremost, every single department, division, unit within Cleveland Metro Parks helped us, from the development folks who raised money for us to build our studio and buy equipment, to marketing, to IT, to the folks at park management who helped us repurpose spaces. It was truly a team effort. We were also able to form several new partnerships. I will speak to Cleveland Municipal School District in a bit. We have, of course, worked with those, with the school district for a number of years, but we were able to engage in a much deeper way. And then finally, we joined the Center for Interactive Learning. That is a international nonprofit that focuses on interactive video conferencing. By joining them, we were able to get our programs out to an international audience, and you'll see we had program participants from over 13 states and 2 countries. So the virtual learning studio, this is the first.
Before
yes.
You leave that other slide.
Yep.
What was roughly the funding from those 4 groups?
That was around $49,000.
$49,000 for the whole, for all 4.
Right, for all 4 combined.
Thank you.
Yep. The virtual learning studio, this was our first mission. Starting in October, we took one of the spaces at the new OEC Management Center and we converted that to a studio. You can see a couple shots there. Had all of the equipment in there that we needed for video production and editing. We were also able to purchase with the grant funding equipment for our live remote program. So extras, microphones, gimbals, all of those things so that we could really be outfitted to produce both quality content video and live interactive content. The first order of business, we had been working on our Facebook Live that was more of a general audience. Obviously, in the fall, we saw that all of our schools were in virtual learning. And so we needed to make this huge shift from in-person place-based learning to the virtual learning, which is what our community needed. So we developed the Virtual Academy. These are grade level programs that are aligned with Ohio's learning standards in science and social studies. We had anywhere from 1 to 5 programs per grade level. We started with an asynchronous version of these. So these would be pre-recorded videos that would include a lesson plan and enrichment activities for the teacher. This way, students could do this in independent learning at home. Teachers could facilitate it on their own. Once we finished that content, into January, we moved into synchronous versions of all of those. So what that means is that a teacher could call into our studio. We would have a naturalist with a group of students, and we would have this interactive experience where we could have live animals in the studio, and we could take questions and answers throughout the program. For the synchronous programs, which we've only really been up and running for a couple of months now, we've impacted over 3,000 students in over 36 classrooms. I mentioned Cleveland Municipal School District. Part of the silver lining of the pandemic was we were asked to join the CLE for Sci initiative. This is the Cleveland Learning Experience for Science collaboration. This has been around for about 10 years. I was involved with this both at my work at Shaker Lakes as well as at the Natural History Museum. What it is a local nonprofit or organization such as Cleveland Metro Parks Partners takes over a grade level, or in some cases, in our case, a band of grades. And we offer enrichment in the science field for students in that grade band. We were asked to work with students in the middle school grades, grades 6 through 8, and to focus on the earth and space science content. So we did, similar to our other virtual learning programs, asynchronous videos with the enrichment and the lesson plan for the students. And we are also able to offer those three programs as an interactive live experience. Next year and beyond, we can plan to continue offering that in a virtual environment and also offer that as an on-site field trip. So we're very excited about this partnership. And then the final initiative within the Virtual Academy focuses on our early learners. The Eco Explorers, which is the mobile outreach initiative that works on early childhood education, funded by PNC Grow Up Great, typically has gone out to visit preschool classrooms, primarily Head Starts, Cleveland Municipal School preschools. We took those 5 learning units that they were taking out to the students, and we turned those into virtual units. We created the video content with the lesson plans, but the real kicker and the thing that I'm most proud of are the learning kits that we developed to go along with it. You see an example of those. Each of the 5 units has a separate learning kit, big tub of items for enrichment related to that content. So it's bug boxes and nets and microscopes, and you see the Twister game that's in there. Teachers can borrow that free of charge. We established a system for lending that out, and they can borrow that and bring those back and work through those various units. So those have been very well received. We've gotten some great feedback. Please, please keep the learning kits. We really love being able to use those in the classroom. Once we felt we had our school community under hand, we wanted to move more into the public space. Again, we have been doing the Facebook Lives, but I'm sure many of you experienced lots and lots of opportunities for Zoom and learning on your own in the evening, on the weekends, all of that. And we wanted to bring that as well. We wanted to take some of those experiences we had previously offered in person, lectures, workshops, sometimes even field trips, outdoor recreation workshops, and turn those into virtual and interactive experiences. So we put our School of the Wilds, which is sort of Naturalist 101. We looked at special events like maple sugaring, and then our outdoor rec team took a lot of what they typically do in person, skills and thrills, backpacking basics 101, and turned those into live programs. As you can see, from December through April, we had over 44 programs and 1,500 participants. We do collect evaluation data on all of our programs. Sometimes can be harder than others to get. As you can imagine, when it's a YouTube video that's on our website, it's harder to get usage. But for those who participated in our live programs, we got across the board very solid positive feedback. In addition to the virtual learning, we did have a restart of our in-person public programs in the late fall. We obviously had to do that with an eye on the current COVID protocols that were in place at the time. So we moved from public programs that were open walk-in to registration-only, limited group size programs, masks, symptom checkers, all of that. We also implemented a new way of planning that program so that we had more consistency across the centers and the units. Programs were at set times in each of the different centers. So for instance, a family parent-child program was at 11 o'clock on Saturdays across all of the nature centers. Those were very well received. Outdoor recreation did a ton of try-its, brought in a great new audience, a lot of families. And our youth outdoors did in-person program with the learning pods that popped up all over the city of Cleveland for families to send their students there for the day to do their virtual learning. We ended up being the enrichment in that more after school kind of hour. So what did we learn this year? Well, we learned a lot, like all of us did. Really proud of the fact that I think in a lot of ways, we really expanded our audience, sometimes in pure numbers, but more than anything in diversity and accessibility. We got comments from people from School of the Wilds of, I'm so glad you're doing this virtually on a Saturday night because I don't drive at night. And if you had done this at North Sugar Nature Center, I wouldn't have been able to participate. So we opened up the door to new audience, to new types of programs. We really tried to tune in on what the community was looking for. They were looking for outside, they were looking for family, they were looking for learning enrichment, they were looking for free, and we were able to offer them. And then obviously, like everybody else, we've learned a ton about technology, but really the use of technology in education and interpretation, how to do these in an interactive way that we could then archive and save that content. So we've now developed an extensive library of our virtual content.
How much of this do you think you maintain going forward?
That is a great idea, and that's actually my very last slide. Oh, no worries. Whoops, I hit it one.
You and Sean must be.
There we go.
They just anticipate very well.
We do. The silver lining. So what does stay with us? You know, virtual learning will stay with us, and that's not just us. I think that is the world. How and when we do it is going to look different in the coming years than it did in this year when everybody was stuck at home. I anticipate we'll be able to turn some of our programs into multimodal programs, so an option to be in person and virtual at the same time, similar to what we're doing here for the board meeting. Very proud of the new partnerships, the CMSD CLEFER-SCI partner. That's over 7,000 potential students every year that we could impact. We're going to need to work to figure out how we can do field trips with them, but that'll probably be a hybrid kind of version as well. School programs, again, all of those, I think we're going to keep those on that virtual option. I think schools are much more comfortable with that, and it does save the time and the cost of transportation for field trips. Of course, being who we are, we really are about getting people outside and connecting with nature. So we are trying to walk that line where we can do both and engage and hopefully engage people in all types of learning. The other lesson that we learned, something that I think will really help us moving forward, is our program and event planning, how to do bigger, larger programs, like my colleague Karen is going to talk about maple sugaring, but also how to schedule and implement programs in a way that's more accessible to people. That is all I have. Do you have any questions?
Mary, I have one question. Mm-hmm. If you compare the staff level that your group has, from 1920, and give us the rough numbers. I guess there's a leadership group, and then there's divided up like that, so I can.
In terms of staffing, you know, again, this has all been very much of a process. Back in April of last year, about half of our team were part-time, mostly part-time educators, and those folks were furloughed. They just came back on board in February. So a whole lot of what we did without that part of the team. As I mentioned before, in addition, the full-time folks from about May until early October were mostly reassigned elsewhere. So we didn't start a lot of the education-based initiatives until October, till we were able to really get back on board with those teams. So
comparing it to
Right. Comparing it to 2019 and where we are today in throwing in seasonals, we are probably at about 70%, 65 to 70. It's a little bit hard to tell because seasonals are money and not positions. Our part-time people are at about half. So
the part-time people, are you having trouble hiring them? Or are you having trouble paying for them?
Almost all of our part-time, almost all of our part-time staff did come back from furlough. Of the, I believe, 15 naturalists that we had, all but two returned when we called them back from furlough.
So the 30% you missed 2019.
Those are seasonals. And then that was also our part-time budget was cut. So the part-timers only have half of the hours that they had before. So we brought them back in waves and most of them are here for just a 6-month period of time.
Okay.
And Mary, is that archival library, is that available to teachers all the time or how does that work?
It is. It's all up on our website. We did a total revamp of the education page for the park side. And there's a tab that talks about virtual learning and all of that content is in there. Under the virtual classroom, you can actually search on it. I want to do amphibians and butterflies or whatever it is. And then under the virtual academy, the grades base, that's all by grade level.
That's an incredible amount of work, and your presentation was spectacular.
Yeah.
So thank you. Very
is this your
much.
First time presenting? Congratulations.
It is. All right, thanks. A couple of those we went around, so.
We hired her, and then we went into a pandemic, and we didn't get to see
right.
Her.
I've spent way more of my time here in pandemic mode than in normal mode, but hopeful.
So you've done an excellent job pivoting, which we all had to, and those virtual programs, I know a lot of people did them. I would say we did them better than everybody else.
I totally agree.
On that note, we will move into out-of-the-park experiences. Maple Sugaring 2021 in person. And Karen Lakis is here, and I will not steal any of her thunder because it is a very cool story.
Sweet.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for having me today. I know we did send some syrup over, so hopefully you enjoyed that, those of you who received it. And I do have a little bit more, so if anybody didn't get any and you want some. March 2021, we brought back maple sugaring at Rocky River Reservation. I'm Karen Lakis. I'm the Naturalist 2 and Volunteer Coordinator over there at Rocky River. And so I'm just going to give you a little update on how we did it this year because it was a little different than we had done in the past. So we have been doing maple sugaring at Maple Grove Picnic Area in Rocky River since 1983. And so here are some photos from that very first year in 1983 when they began this program. And we've faced a lot of challenges through the years. Very, very cold weather, lots of snow. This program takes place late February, early March, so you never know what you're going to get. Also, flooding has been an issue through the years. It's right next to the river. So lots of things, yeah, but we never faced anything, of course, like we faced starting in March of 2020. So March of 2020, we finished our second weekend of maple sugaring. We still had one more weekend to go and we had to close. So we only got halfway through the event. I had just started at Rocky in 2019. So this was my first time coordinating the event. And it was going really well until we had to shut down. After the holidays in 2020, January 2021, I approached my manager, Val Fetzer, and said, hey, are we going to do maple sugaring this year? We've been doing it, you know, for 37 years. Are we going to be able to? So Val went to Mary and Mary to Joe, and we got I created a proposal and we got approval to go forward with the event. And there were so many questions. So first of all, were we going to do it? Okay, yes. Would we have the staff to do it? Our part-timers were still furloughed. We were working with just full-timers. And, you know, would we have enough people? We did in the end. Because our part-timers slowly returned. They returned the week we tapped the trees, but they came back. How would the pandemic look? How would things be in March? Would we be worse? Would it be better? Nobody knew. We all know that nobody knew. Would we have enough time to put this event together? We only had 2 months. Usually, you know, we would start planning for the next year when the previous year ended. So could we pull this all together in a couple of months? But in the end, you know, we decided that we wanted to continue this tradition. We wanted a 38th season of maple sugaring at Rocky River. And that nature was not closed. No matter what we did, the sap was still going to flow. And so let's give it a try. Let's do our best to get out there and do this again this year. And so this was actually the photo here was the weekend that we closed in 2020. And we were on track to have our highest attendance ever at this event in 2020 when we had to shut down. So in mid-February of 2021, we reached out to our maintenance, our park ops team, and they went out and they set up our sugar shack as they have every year since 1983. We convert the Maple Grove picnic shelter into a sugar house where we cook syrup. And I believe we're still using the very same walls that they started with in 1983, but they were able to do that for us on very short notice. I started reaching out to volunteers. They're the backbone, you know, of this program because we had, it's a lot of work. And we weren't sure how volunteers were going to feel. Would they want to come out? You know, it was still a very scary time, but we were able to reach out and they were so happy to help. So from tree tapping at the end of February to sap gathering a couple times a week to working at the event, they were on board the whole time. I have such a wonderful crew of people there. The man in the red there is Dane. He's our syrup maker. So Dane, without Dane, you know, we would be able to pull it off, but it would be hard. So he came and he was able to cook the syrup for us throughout the event. And you can see everybody wore their masks and we distanced. So we put up stanchions in front of the sugar house, which we didn't used to have at a 6 foot distance just to keep the public away. At a 6 foot distance, and that worked out really well, and I'll probably keep those in the future just for safety purposes. I think they were just a good feature to have. So anyway, our volunteers were on board. We did in the beginning of the planning decide to change the name of the event because we didn't want people to think it was going to be exactly the same as it had always been, because it wasn't. So we went from calling it the History of Maple Sugaring, which had been its name from 1983 to 2020, and we called it Maple Sugaring at Rocky River Reservation. Very basic, but it just basically told you exactly what it was. And I think we're going to keep that new name because it started out as more of a kind of a social studies program, but through the years, we have a lot of very scientific people working. The naturalists like to talk about the science of maple sugaring. And so it's morphed into a kind of a hybrid between the history and the nature a little bit more. So this gives us a little more leeway to talk about that science a little bit more if we're not calling it a history program. So we're probably going to keep that name. So here is was one of the backbones of maple sugaring, which was the naturalist-led hike. This is a photo from 1983, and if you have been here for a while, you might remember that naturalist in the front there. That's Kathy Schmidt. She just retired a couple of years ago from, but she was back there in 1983 when this first started. So the naturalist-led hike is a big deal. You would take a group, you would gather a group at certain intervals, you would take them through the woods and talk to them about the process. We knew in 2021, we weren't going to be able to do that with large groups. So in 2021, with very little time, I was able to write up signs and Viscom was able to produce the signs. So instead of having a naturalist lead a large group of people through the woods, we made it a self-guided tour. We had two different trails because at Maple Grove, you have trails on both sides of the sugar bush. So we had two identical trails on either side so that people could be distanced. And we put the signs out for them to learn about maple sugaring and the whole process. And so they could walk the trail on their own with their own small little family group at their own pace. But we did have naturalists roving the woods. So if they did want to talk to someone, if they did want to interact, they could. Or if they wanted to be left alone, they could as well. So this is something we're probably going to keep in a hybrid way for next year. We're probably going to have a self-guided trail and a naturalist-led trail. So we'll have two ways for people to enjoy the event because we really did feel it worked well. At the another thing we introduced in 2021 was in the parking lot, we had a greeting station. So we had volunteers and naturalists at the greeting station orienting people when they came in, because for years and years, people were used to just walking straight to the sugar house, but things were a little different this year. So we had people greeting them. We had masks available. We had sanitizer available. You can see behind those two, we had distancing signs. We had please wear your mask. It's required signs. So we really, really enforced that whole like welcome to our event. But, you know, we do need to follow some guidelines right at the beginning, and received so little pushback from people. They were just so happy that we were having the event. People were perfectly willing to wear their masks outdoors for the event. So the greeting table was a good thing, which I think we will also keep as well in the future. So when you finished your hike through the woods, you went back by the sugar house, and we had several stations set up showing you the historic ways that syrup was made in the past by American Indians and by pioneers. And we had staff at those stations, so they would explain to you what was going on as you watched the sap boil into syrup. But if you wanted to be left alone, we also had signs there, so you could read the sign. Or if the naturalist was engaged with someone else or had walked away for a moment, you could read the sign and see what was going on at that station. And this was totally new. We had never had stations quite like this before with signs. So we will keep those in the future as well. They were very well received. So this year, in the past, we'd always had opportunities to taste maple syrup that we made. You can see that photo from 1983, the volunteers squirting syrup on the little kids' fingers.
The pancakes are delicious.
Yeah, we made we had had crackers through the years. We had made little silver dollar pancakes through the years. So this year, we decided not to do any of that because it was just a lot of touching and closeness. And we did that behind the sugar house there. There's grills set up, and that's where we'd make the pancakes. And on the side there, we'd sell little maple candies that we bought up from Geauga County in bulk and had volunteers wrap. Well, this year, we didn't really want to have these wrapping parties for the candies and things like that. So most of that went out the window this year. But what we did offer was the food truck. So we approached the food truck folks and asked if they wanted to come to our event. And so they made up a special menu for us. We gave them many gallons of our syrup from past years, and they were able to use that to serve with their French toast sticks and to make their maple candied bacon. And this was such a hit. They sold out of food every day. They were there for a total of 15 hours. But they made $7,000, which is really good. So they said that was the best event that they had been to yet. So we hope to have them back in the future. I think people are going to want that. After they had it this year, they're definitely going to want it again. So that was a wonderful feature we introduced this year. We also had great marketing support. We were on Kicking It with Kenny. We were on New Day Cleveland. We were in the paper. So marketing really got us a lot of great opportunities to get the word out about our event. So how did we do? Well, pretty well. So our final attendance, we only had 4 days this year because we didn't really know how things were going to be. So we did 2 weekends, Saturday and Sunday, March 7th and 8th and 13th, 14th. And over those 4 days, we had 4,875 visitors. So compare that to 2020 in 3 days, 2019, we had 6 public days, 2018, 2017, we had 6 public days. So we had double the amount of people in only the 4 days that we were open in 2021.
How do you explain that?
Well, I explained that by a couple things. One was great weather. The weather every day was 40s and 50s and sunny. So it was perfect maple sugaring weather. We couldn't have asked for better weather. But also, people were so ready to get out. And we had so many.
It was actually Karen. It was her first full year there. Yeah. So it was just.
It was all me. People were so ready to get out, and over through the event, people just would approach us and say, thank you for doing this. Because they everything had been canceled for a year. And Maple Sugaring was our last outdoor experiences event in 2020 and our first one back. So that was in a year. So people were so ready to come. And so over and over, they said, thank you for doing this. They didn't even seem to care, you know, that certain things weren't like they had been. They were just so happy that we were there, and they were happy to see their naturalists again and to get out in the park again and have an event. So it was a really, really wonderful first event back. And we were very, very fortunate to have.
Were many of the, I'm just curious what the proportion of new people that hadn't experienced.
Lots. We had a lot of new people. I don't have specific numbers on that, but people, what we noticed was this trend of young families with little teeny kids coming, you know, parents, young families. So we had a lot of returners who said, hey, you know, I've been coming to this for blah, 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 but so many new people. So I was really glad we had that greeting table at the front to orient people. So the returners could be oriented to the changes, but the new people could be oriented just to the event. So lots and lots of young families with young kids, which if that continues, I definitely will think about ways to try to engage that. And with the food truck there, it was really nice because people had something to eat. A lot of the, like Frostville usually does a pancake breakfast, and that was canceled this year. And so people wanted the food, and that kept them there all day. So they would come and they would stay all day, and the kids would play in the grove. And it was just like a big festival. It was just so fun and so wonderful to see. People were so happy to be out.
Karen, I think you guys also did a really good job on the promotional side too, between Twitter and Instagram and emails going out, event scheduling, and I think that's helping reach some folks that, you know, we haven't traditionally reached.
Yeah,
it's pretty powerful to get some new people in.
You're right. You know, having just the online promotion versus the print promotion, you know, I didn't have flyers, I didn't have an emerald necklace, you know, but having everything online and then being on TV, that brought in a whole new crop of people that we'd never seen before. So especially those real young families. So that definitely made a difference. But, you know, in 38 years, a lot of things have changed, but some things have remained exactly the same. So thank you for your support of our event, and thank you for letting us have it. And I hope you enjoyed your syrup, and thank you for letting me be here.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your numbers.
Yeah.
And again, please pass along our gratitude to all of the naturalists and
yes,
all of the education staff for the last year. It's been certainly a hard work year for us. The next information item is a planning for the RAISE grant. Sarah is quickly walking in because this is a very big deal, and Sean McDermott is following right behind.
Hello, everyone.
And good Dan Moore is playing music.
Yes.
That's your walk-up.
Walk-up song.
I feel like I should strut or something. Thank you, everyone. Good to see you this morning. So the RAISE grant opportunity is what I'm here to talk to you about this morning. It is an acronym, of course, Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity. It's a discretionary grant program, and formerly known as the BUILD program and TIGER program. And the application is open right now. The NOFO, Notice of Funding Opportunity, was released on April 13th. It's due on July 12th. And there's $1 billion available under the program, same as last year with BUILD program. A little bit different this time is, again, they're offering planning. They have a little bit more allocated towards planning this year, $30 million available, with at least $10 million coming from areas of persistent poverty as defined by the U.S. Census and the RAISE grant office. 50% of the awards have to go to urban areas and 50% to rural areas. And the minimum award is $5 million for urban, $1 million for rural, which is similar to in past rounds, and then no more than $100 million per state. And there is no minimum for planning projects. And it is the typical 80-20 local match, except for in those rural areas, in areas of persistent poverty, you can go up to 100% match. And we have a quick obligation window with this round of funding. Our TIGER program where we got the TIGER grant in 2016, that had an extra year of obligation. This is a little bit shorter window. And so the applications, they're due July 12th. They're statutorily required to let you know by middle of November. I think it's November 20th, if I'm not mistaken. If you've been awarded, it does take time to get under contract if you are successful. But all the funds have to be obligated by September 30th of 2024 and spent down by 2029. And one thing that the SNOFO is very similar to the way the project's been run in past years, although there's a lot more emphasis on equity in areas of those persistent poverty, and a really strong emphasis on partnerships, much more so than in past rounds. So that's, you know, when you go and you listen to the webinars on the funding opportunities, you know, they tell you what they're looking for. That's what they're looking for with this project. And sustainability and climate resiliency are also very large. So I've talked to you in the past about the Cuyahoga Greenways plan and the Cuyahoga Greenway partners, the work that we've been doing. Back in the fall, we did west side and east side connections and planning that we've been doing both as Cleveland Metro Parks and with our partners. So we're going off of the Cuyahoga Greenways plan that we also recently adopted, Cleveland Metro Parks did. And we're looking at these critical gaps and regional links, especially to build out the network. And the Greenway Partners has gone through over the last several months priming for opportunities like this, knowing that there'd likely be this discretionary grant program coming again, and figuring out what would be the likely projects that would score well, could be bundled together in an application. And these are the projects that we've, as a collective with the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners, identified from the plan that these would probably be the most competitive for a planning application. The Euclid Creek Greenway, the Phase 2/3, Slavic Village Downtown Connector Phase 2, the Iron Court Opportunity Corridor Connector, Booth Avenue Connector, and also the Jennings Towpath Connector. One thing I'll mention about the Jennings Towpath, though, is that it's a really small project. And there's opportunity with the sewer district with a project that they're doing kind of within the right of way that, given timing issues, that one kind of drops out. This was the list that had been generated back in January and March. And since that time, that opportunity. So the city of Cleveland is working with the sewer district to see about that Jennings connection. Areas of persistent poverty, like I mentioned, that kind of salmon color on the map is what qualifies under the census definition of areas of persistent poverty. So you'll see it's a large portion of the county is actually in those areas of persistent poverty. And it's a little hard to read on this map, I'm sorry, but the Cuyahoga Greenways plan is overlaid on this. So you can see where those critical gaps are and the key routes and regional links. And so those are the projects that I talked about, minus the Jennings Connector. But those are the projects that for a planning project would likely score well. They are in those areas of persistent poverty. They're making key connections. They're derived from the Greenways plan. They're priorities of multiple agencies. And so those are the ideas that the Cuyahoga Greenway Partners and, you know, the partnership with City of Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, Cleveland Metro Parks have said kind of bubble up as being the projects that should we submit a planning application, these would be the most logical.
Sarah, is that one, the Slavic Village one, is it outside of the persistent poverty area or is it the coloring a little?
It's hugging, so it's hugging a non-residential census tract.
So it has.
And so it's just, you have to qualify it. And there's some language in the NOFO too that would still qualify.
Got it, good, thank you.
Yeah.
It's dotted. What is that now?
That one, good call. I haven't advanced far enough. That's Slavic Village Downtown Connector Phase 1. That project has some funding already associated from the city of Cleveland. And so it's in the hatching just to see that could potentially be added to the bundle because there is some local match, even though these projects wouldn't necessarily require a local match under the program, but could be included in the bundle if it did not impact the overall timing of the project. So that's a discussion for Cleveland, NOAACA, ODOT, you know, whether to include it or not, but that's a potential.
Does local match help in, if even if it isn't required?
The NOFO says it's not part of the selection process, but in general, when we, yeah, when we put in our Tiger application the first time and worked with a consultant, there was a certain level that made you more competitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarah, the spread of Cleveland coming west from the Euclid Creek Greenway Phase 3, mm-hmm. you see that whole area in the center there.
Mm-hmm.
That would crack out. Yeah, got the lakefront, goes to Brattonall, and then that so, the other one that's
clear.
Kind of in through here.
Yeah, in a little, that whole spread in the middle there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of poverty in there. I think that would sort of attract, that would be attractive, I think, to Democratic.
Well,
but I think the areas you circled are ideal as well, but they're here. They do, because we've already started with them.
And that is part of why I went through the obligation, the funding obligation. If we're going through and doing a planning application and getting to construction documents, we have to be able to obligate each of those phases of funding. So we would have to have right away be able to be cleared in order to get to final design. And so that is part of the idea of what is poised to do.
But the Euclid Street, the Euclid Creek tension, that's hard to get to construction documents for that.
Yeah, and that one we might have to just stop at preliminary engineering to be able to
but maybe
make sure we use the funds.
Engineering in the center area of Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Could be another area.
There are a lot of other projects that are also going on right now with the NOAACA and the county's lakefront access studies, as well as a downtown connection study that regional study that NOAACA is doing. So there are some other planning efforts that are getting to some of those questions that will likely result in recommendations for other projects. So some of that is making sure we're not getting ahead of those projects as well. And I did not put up the slide of the implementation projects that the Greenway Partners has also identified as being the most likely to move forward for a program like this. And that includes the Lorraine Cycle Track and also the Superior Midway as projects to construct, because they have some funding already dedicated to them. They have CMAQ funding through NOAACA awards, but there's a funding gap for them. And so, as the Greenway Partners, we've looked at those are the ones that are poised, and that speaks a little bit, not to that whole section, but some of the east side, where not only just for getting through design, but to actually get projects built, that those ones under the city of Cleveland would make sense to advance.
Yeah.
So Cleveland would put that submission in on the implementation side.
Yeah.
Sarah, the red dotted line coming down from just above the Euclid Creek label. What's that path?
That is one of the regional links. Let me make sure I'm that one.
Yeah, right there. That one.
So that's Euclid Avenue. That is one of the regional links for the Greenways plan, also on the East Side Greenway, of just the importance of Euclid Avenue as a corridor,
okay,
as an east-west corridor.
I understand.
Yeah.
It's pretty shaky out. Look at that corridor. It's really nice after University Circle, but before that, not really a bike path.
Right.
Where they have.
Right. And that was some of
the in someone's eye.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think that's one of those areas that's been recognized as an important linkage, and then little pieces of it are being bitten off. There's a Transportation for Livable Communities Initiative planning study underway right now that we've been a part of, looking at the Euclid Green area. So it's covering improvements for right through this section.
Okay.
And so some of these, you just have to segment them down and work on a piece at a time. There's some resurfacing that's happening on the Euclid portion of Euclid Avenue as well in the upcoming year. So the city of Euclid's been very, very involved in looking at ways to extend bicycle and pedestrian facilities throughout their entire city, and this corridor being one as well. But those are, as I said, the projects that everyone has kind of rallied around as being the ones, not that they're necessarily the most important or best, but what would fit the funding source the most and be most competitive in an application cycle. So our next step is working to determine if we are going to, not sure how to get that off, if we are going to be submitting an application, will it be a joint application, just kind of the logistics of it. And we've been talking with City of Cleveland and Cuyahoga County as well, as I mentioned too, the Cuyahoga Greenway partners, figuring out what that bundle is. And to the point too, if we have some funding that's available to put up as local match, City of Cleveland has some funding in their budget this year for Euclid Creek Greenway and for Slavic Village Downtown Connector Phase 2, because we've been talking about needing to do the traffic studies and things. So that's a possibility that there's already committed budgeted funding that could be put towards local match. And then writing the application, so.
Is that money, the Cleveland money, that the anticipated 500 budget, right?
No, this was on the budget before the rescue funds. So because as we've been working these projects through the Cuyahoga Greenway partners as a result of the Greenways plan, it's what are those next steps that we need to take? We need traffic studies. We need to advance it. We do site visits, and really with, you know, the multidisciplinary and multi-agency groups going out, there was a ride this past September for Euclid Creek Greenway Phase 2 with members of county planning and City of Cleveland, us. So we're advancing these. And so as a result of that, you know, some budget funds were allocated for City of Cleveland for Euclid Creek Greenway.
So. Very good.
But this is a primer. We'd have more next month. Hopefully we'll have everything kind of nailed down.
You've got a tall order to fill after Tiger Grant.
Yeah, we got to put something, now that's ending, we've got to.
Yeah, raised a little bit.
Yeah, we got to add back to the pot, so hopefully. It's a very competitive program. I don't think it's gotten any less so, but it's always worth the try, right?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You don't get it if you don't ask. All right, the next information item is Hinkley Lake Dam. This is just a project update. This is something we've been working on for a period of time. Just wanted to give a brief update on the work that's been going on.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Good morning, commissioners. Again, as Brian said, we're going to give a very quick project update here on Hinkley Lake Dam. We are at 75, it's not showing up too hot, but 75% drawings, which is a very good thing. These projects are complicated. They take time and a lot of due diligence. So we're happy to be with Michael Baker at this stage of 75% drawings, and also working with Great Lakes Construction on cost estimating through their construction manager risk pre-construction activities. So just a quick refresher, we've got Hinkley Lake held back by both a concrete spillway and earthen embankment of Hinkley Dam. And then we've got the spillway swim area just on the downside of the concrete spillway itself. Quick look back, started construction in 1926. The lake was filled in 1927. So you know, we are getting close to that 100-year mark. The lake and the dam have performed extremely well, although because it is 100 years old, we certainly do not have modern design standards in terms of how the dam was constructed to today's standards. So I've got some real quick images as a refresher. This would be, I kind of cut a section through the dam to show you what things would look like. So on a normal day, you can see the water relative to that embankment elevation. 100-year flood, so that's when we get a 100-year storm, which is this hydrograph that just popped up. You can see it's fully contained in the lake, and it would not be anticipated that we would have any issues. Where the issue comes in is that if we were to receive that PMF, probable maximum flow, that is considering a hurricane remnant. We're talking like a several day drenching, some an event of biblical proportions. That's when the water overflows, could overflow the top of the embankment. And then we have erosion on the backside and a potential for failure. So that is the concern, the first concern with Hinckley Dam. So we went through, and we've been in front of you several times about all the options. The most economical and most easily constructed option, and I flipped the direction of the cross sections on you, but is raising the earthen embankment. So Great Lakes has worked with us to price that out and work through all the details. So I want to walk you through what that looks like with a raised embankment of about 6 feet or so. Your normal water level is as shown. Your 100-year flood is as shown. And your that biblical event, that PMF, completely stored in the lake with a little bit of freeboard as well. But what does that do? Oh, by the way, we finally got out there this year in kayaks. It had been some time because we wanted to get an idea now that we are at 75% plans to see how things would look. So from the lake perspective, this is last Friday. This is what you look like as you approach that spillway. Okay? Adding on top of those embankments, it really doesn't change the look, the feel, the experience. So we're pretty confident in moving forward from an aesthetic standpoint. But what does this mean? So we come in, we raise the embankments, and then that assures that that probable maximum flood gets pushed over a reconstructed concrete spillway. And why is that important? This today, and we cut another cross section, this is what the spillway looks like in section. The issue is when we have that flood, the spillway actually could rotate and shift. That is the second finding that we have when we have the dam inspected. So what we need to do.
Question there.
Yes.
It's been there for 100 years.
Yes, it has.
So having it twist, measure that.
It has an extremely low probability. The issue is that it's greater than zero. So when we work with Ohio Department of Natural Resources and their dam safety program, unfortunately, what is there doesn't meet standards of today. And it's 100 years old. How could they have known how weather would change, how storm intensities would change, how design parameters would change? Correct. So what we have is a actually rather simple physics problem. So what we will do, oh, that was kind of cool. What we'll do is create a much more massive spillway with a toe. And what we will lock it into the bedrock. And this is, like I said, simple physics. We will create more weight so that that whole overturning force cannot have any chance of rotating that spillway.
That requires taking it off.
It actually doesn't. Working with Great Lakes Construction, we've developed a really, really good idea. We're going to keep the existing spillway. We're going to cut the top off, and we're going to use the spillway as a form. So that'll be on the south side. We'll use it as a form, and then we'll dowel in the new spillway. That way, there's a complete mess of silt back here. And if we were to take that spillway out, we'd have a whole other set of issues to work
with. Dig on the dry side.
Exactly. So we're going to work in the dry. It'll still be challenging because we have to manage the river. But we really like the solution. It saves money, it saves time, and it saves a lot of headache.
You have to make sure you don't hold back structure.
That's exactly correct.
So how do you connect two concrete? So you'll have rebar going in, but I would think you
so we're working with Michael Baker. We will physically and mechanically connect the systems with a tremendous amount of steel rebar. And then we're actually to the point where this, we will dowel it. This piece of concrete is so large, it's considered a mass pour. So we'll be using special concrete. We might even, like a la Hoover Dam, we might even need to run some cooling tubes. And then abandon them in place, because anytime you get a really thick mass pour of concrete, your heat hydration, all those issues continue to show up time and time again. So we're working through those details of exactly how to build this. Great Lakes has done mass concrete before, so we're pretty confident in that process.
Right, you'll require drainage.
Yeah, yes, and we'll get to that. You guys are really good with your questions today. So
underneath there, though, to build that little heel or whatever.
We will probably both excavate and make sure that we don't have too much load on the backside. And we may actually drill caisson depending on depending on methods.
It's almost like you're going.
Yes, exactly. So the second part of the project then is, this is a very rare opportunity we have. The lake's 100 years old. It's served very well, but as you can see by the depths that we sonared, back of the lake is heavily silted in, and where we really need to concentrate our efforts is in front of the boathouse here. We're seeing a lot of deposition from the east branch of the Rocky River. You can see a lot of the silt veins and how it's formed over time. So what we want to do is really concentrate our dredging operations here, because once you launch your kayak out of the boathouse, if you're anywhere back here, it's 6 inches deep. It's a foot deep. It's very shallow. So that's where we want to concentrate efforts. So here's a great opportunity we have. We need about 15,000 cubic yards of clay to build our dam embankment. Okay. Well, we did some geotechnical analysis in and around Hinckley Reservation. And we can, the perfect clay that we need is at the back of the Buzzard's Roost meadow, if you will. Natural Resources is completely supportive of this approach. So we could mine the clay we need from Buzzard's Roost, and then we would then have a borrow pit, use that at the dam. And then any dredging that we generate here, we could then build a haul road and not only fill the borrow, but then probably overfill, because quite honestly, we could dredge 25,000, 40,000, 60,000. We could dredge as much as we want. There's a need for it. So what does all this mean? The next steps, we're thinking right now that the dam is about $7 million, which is actually pretty good, considering what our cost estimates have been in the past, especially with other design solutions. So we've been anywhere from 6 to 12. And we're pretty satisfied with what Great Lakes and Baker have worked with us on in terms of finding solutions to stay at a relatively, when you compare this to other class one dams in Ohio, this is very economical. It's still a ton of money, but comparatively it's economical relatively. So we're working with Great Lakes on establishing that GMP. While we are submitting to permitting agencies, ODNR Dam Safety already had our pre-application with Ohio EPA and starting the process with the Army Corps of Engineer, and then determine the dredging scope. Now, Natalie and Kristen from development, we continue to hammer each and any opportunity that comes about in terms of funding. Unfortunately, there just do not seem to be a lot of funding programs, even though there are hundreds of class one dams across the country that are in worse shape than this one. So we're really pressing hard. I know we reached out to Representative Gonzalez and others to try and fit this in. So we're pushing any and everywhere we can so that not the entire project cost has to come out of.
So who pays additionally is paid? Class one. Hasn't the state of Ohio supported?
They've supported it, but most of their support goes to ODNR.
They're theirs. DMs.
Yes.
Most of them are theirs.
Yes. But when it comes to utilities and other private owners, they are paying for them. They are taking on the bill themselves.
I think it was just important to bring this forward. This is a, you know, it's a big spend. It's a long-term commitment. And by taking our time on this, we've really worked on refining methods and working with our partners at Baker and our construction contractor. We've worked very hard at bringing this number down and figuring out soils and movements. And so it's a very complex opportunity here to really improve it. So we do appreciate everyone's patience along the way and making sure that we can fund this properly as well.
Has the 100-year flood value changed over the years? That used to be kind of the benchmark. Right now you've got this new flood level.
It has in terms of design standards for dams. If we look at what happened in Michigan last spring, that was beyond 100 year, and that took out three. It took out one completely and impacted two others because they were in a series on a river. So yes, standards have become more stringent.
Well, events have been.
And events have become more impactful.
Intense and frequent.
Can I ask one question? You're dealing with weight. You're loading the side of the dam. Have you thought about running the other side of the dam, backing up the dam with just some heavy concrete, sunk in with piles and concrete filled pile, you know, down into the earth? That would give you the same thing. So it would give you it would be pushing on the dam. Are you worried about the dam breaking?
We're worried about everything, to be honest. And we have looked at that. Here's the interesting thing. When we were doing some of our geotechnical evaluation, we bored and we actually we encountered an artesian condition where the lake is here, the spillway is here, and we were getting bubbling from our geotechnical boring. So we've got to be really careful about if we're going to start driving pile and things like that, we could actually create more issues than we solve. But to your point, yes, we're looking at those ways as to how most economically and efficiently create that mass that we need at the spillway.
If we have to pay for it ourselves, it's another matter if the feds contribute, but that's a hell of a lot of, $6 million, $7 million, a lot of money for us.
It is, plus dredging, we can't forget. That's the dam cost, we need the dredging cost is separate.
What's our timing that we would like to get this project underway?
Very good question. We need to consider that we probably have to drain the lake and let the lake dewater for a good amount of time. This project could take 2 years, like once we start.
Yeah.
Timing is a function of, we probably have a year left in terms of the permitting process through OEPA and ODNR and the Army Corps. And then it's, you know, hopefully we can start to push on FEMA to get some funds to help offset part of that $7 million.
But this whole time, there is a potential risk of this epic storm happening. Yeah. I mean, that just could happen any time.
Yes, there's no way to say no. But and that's.
Nor had a pandemic.
No, the pandemic.
I guess, Dad, you're right.
Pandemic went bad. This is
true.
This is 1,000 years.
Plan for it.
Yeah.
So,
thank you.
Nice, good presentation.
Yeah. Thank you.
Certainly a complete freedom.
Yeah, that's
wow.
A huge.
Again, I applaud everybody's work on this. It's you know, part of who we are, and it's a big project for us. The next information item is a Lakefront Greenway. This is a sidewalk enhancement project partnership. Sean, Sarah.
Thanks. Yeah, we will probably tag team this one. When opportunity strikes. So we have a great opportunity here to continue the Lakefront Greenway, continue all that work to string together assets along the lakefront and create that multimodal opportunity for residents and our guests. So I'm not going to walk through everything here, but what you can see both in terms of all-purpose trails and on-street bike trails, we've got Rocky River Reservation, Edgewater, Brookside, et cetera, is this developing network. And what you also see in that developing network is that there is a hole. That hole exists on Lake Avenue in Cleveland. This is West 117th Street. This is West Boulevard at the end of Edgewater Park. This dashed line represents newly striped bike lanes in Lakewood where they took over some former parking lanes and they are fantastic. And this section between Cove and 117th, the dotted line represents some future improvements, near future improvements that are in the works. So
is that actually going to be a bike lane? You said bike lane, or is it just a shared?
It is, it's a point of discussion and I will come back to it.
Okay. Because the road, it's just terrible, that road, to ride a bike on that road, terrible.
It is very tight because of the population density in all of those apartments who need parking.
Condition of the road too.
Is horrid.
Yeah, the condition of the road from on the Cleveland side is atrocious.
But that's going to be redone this year, I believe.
That's where we're going. Yes. So I'm not going to go over each and every one of these, but here's, and we're also going to use the same presentation for all the neighbors' engagement. But what we're showing here is that there is incredible planning precedent, years and years and years, many plans that focus on this exact stretch of roadway and the need for multimodal facilities. So the US bike routes, our regional bike plan, Cuyahoga Greenways, the lakefront public access plan that's currently going underway, and NOAACA's connectivity plan. And then a bunch of safety policies and existing and burgeoning facilities, both on the west side and our own. And then that Lake Avenue resurfacing project that will take that pretty horrid experience and make a much nicer one. But what it doesn't do is does not create any bike facilities on Lake from 117th to Clifton. So we've got Cleveland Lakefront Bikeway that exists. It's on a map. Right now it's on Edgewater on a road, but we're talking about Lake Avenue specifically here in this section. We've got a US and state bike route that goes in the exact area that we're talking about. We also have our regional bike plan. Here's the interesting thing about the regional bike plan. It lists, not just on a map, but it physically lists where these bikes, these facilities should be. So there can be no doubt or debate. Lake Avenue, West 117th, the West Boulevard. Okay, so Wackett in 2013 made this a statement, and I don't want to say a priority in terms of implementation, but a priority in terms of planning. So we are now at the point where we hope to implement that. Also, Cuyahoga Greenways, the part that we're talking about is a regional link. So again, very important to getting done. We're talking about this portion right here. Sorry, I'm bouncing around a bit. But you can see here that on the Greenways plan, Lake Avenue shown as a regional link. So again, the precedent is there, all the work is there. Now it's time to implement. So also on the Cuyahoga Lakefront Connection Plan, this area is shown as necessary. And then, like I said before, working with NOAACA on their lakefront connectivity plan, where it will be evident that this area is necessary for a connection. When you add in Cleveland's Vision Zero efforts to get accidents, especially pedestrian and bike accidents, down to zero, this project can fit very nicely into that. Also, complete and green streets. There's adopted ordinances that quite honestly aren't followed as strictly as they should be when roads are improved. We can talk about that for hours, but we're here to hopefully implement some complete and green street policy, not policies, but actual implementation with the Lake Avenue piece. NOAACA, in addition to Cleveland, has a clean and green streets ordinance, if you will, or policy, and we're trying to see that that as well is implemented. Okay, so this is more for the benefits of the residents, but we wanted to show here is that, and you saw this two board meetings ago, wanted to show how over time the network has grown in terms of the all-purpose trail system in Metro Parks itself and where things are today. And you can see that, you know, there was a gap there, and then Lakewood came in and did what they did on Clifton and on Lake. So now we are focusing just on this small gap here. But here's the very interesting thing. And we've got about 32.8 miles from the marina to the towpath. But now look what happens when we make this connection. Okay? You have a nearly uninterrupted circuit. And this is what we're trying to replicate here. East side in smaller versions here. So this little piece becomes very important. So with that, the city of Cleveland went through their project after Lakewood put the lanes on Lake Avenue. City of Cleveland and their Lake Road project did not include any bike facilities. So what it did include was a repaving from 117th to Clifton. And from Clifton to Detroit, they did include bike facilities. They went through a rather, how long was the public engagement process? Like 5 weeks or so, 5 or 6 weeks over the holidays. They they got a lot of feedback, and I'll walk through some of that. But the number two feedback was, why are there no bicycle facilities for plans from 117th to Clifton? And over 160 individuals provided public feedback, and we listened, not our project, but we watched it very closely. We actually went to NOAACA, to their Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Council, and made things a little interesting, because we really thought that the project should include bicycle facilities from 117th to Clifton. And we then struck up an idea and a partnership, and here's what we're looking to do. Cuyahoga County has said that they will provide a 20% match to the project. They will provide that to the city of Cleveland, and then the city of Cleveland will then set their 20% match aside, and we will then work as Metro Parks to take what is a pretty narrow sidewalk today on a large tree lawn and convert that to a widened concrete sidewalk that will act both for pedestrians and bicyclists. And we can do that without impacting trees. We can do that without too much disruption. And actually, when you compare it to the typical cost of construction per mile, relatively cheap, because we don't need to do storm sewers. We don't need to do a ton of grading. It is a sidewalk enhancement project. With that, though, we have over 50 residents to work with, looking to start that here pretty soon. And so here, I'll walk through some project facts. So we're looking to replace the sidewalk between 8 to 10 feet wide. It's about 0.9 miles between West Boulevard and West 117th. We have the potential to also do the section between West Boulevard and Clifton. We own that. That's the section that fronts Edgewater Park. So we could do that, and we very well may be able to afford it. In working with the city of Cleveland, they have asked Cleveland Metro Parks to be responsible for the construction, the capital maintenance, and regular maintenance. They are providing the initial cost to construct that $690,000. We have already given special consideration to the trees. We've hired an arborist. We've done studies, and we would do this project outside of the city's repaving. We would come on the heels of it afterwards, so we're not providing even more disruption to the residents. So there's a ton of details here. There's a ton of coordination that needs to happen with the neighbors, because this is unique. It's a change. We understand that. At the same time, I think we've demonstrated just how important this link is and what it means for connectivity locally and regionally.
When we talked about this last time, we were very concerned. I'm not concerned. They'd be upset. How are we going to get that figure?
So Sarah and I have worked very hard with Cleveland Planning Commission and the city's, the mayor's Office of Capital Projects, and have developed a robust community engagement plan, so much so that we have broken down the section of lake to blocks where we have, is it five, four? We have four like hyper-focused neighborhood meetings that will start the first week of June, and then we will have another wider meeting coming up June 15th, where we want to talk to the residents first, because this is a change. They'll have lots of questions. We know that some may not have open arms on this, but it's important. This is the way to get it done, and we're going to engage, and we're going to listen and do everything we can do to make the project as palatable as possible. But we're not just trying to ram this in. We're taking a very, very concerted effort to do engagement first.
But what happens ultimately, because there will be people who say absolutely not, is it a project that can move forward? I'm sure others will be supportive. I know others that will be supportive, so there'll be a mix, but.
It's Cleveland property.
So the two things that are crucial here. The project occurs completely within public right-of-way. The right-of-way line is screen left. Second thing is, Councilperson Spencer has been a great partner. She understands the challenges, but completely supports, with the caveat that we need to work with the neighbors.
Sure.
But this is something that is supported political level, and also from the financial commitment from the city. And there will be, we can't please everybody.
Sure.
Yeah, there'll be.
Is it less disruptive to do it as a separate project? Because I'm imagining when the city does the repaving, you know, people's driveway access is going to be impacted. So does this just delay that? Like, now I've got my driveway impacted at two different times?
It was a very specific request from the Mayor's Office of Capital Projects that we not overlap. Very specific.
And did they give a reason?
No.
It was a very specific request.
Interesting.
And we're trying to adhere to, I mean, we need to work with them and go through them for.
Yeah, obviously.
Got to work, so.
And the roads to be repaved too soon.
Yes. Yeah. So we wanted to bring this before you. We're pretty excited about it because honestly, this is a pilot. It's a test. And this could be portions of this in terms of how we're executing it could be a great model for how we connect park to park. Because without going, there is not an on-road solution for all these connections. And if we want to have an all ages and abilities network where families, you know, because not all families are going to use bike lanes. If we want to connect these parks, this is a very important way to do it. And then to the question asked earlier, Lakewood would then likely continue this treatment from 117th to Cove.
You can do it on that side too without us.
But very creative way to do it. It's super economical.
It's safe, really.
Yes.
So what about the north extension of St. Clair?
Well, yes, I mean, this, as Sean said, it can be a model for some of those areas where you just have to think creatively to get through. And so we've talked to Oakwood Village that has a similar treatment. They have an asphalt trail that they put in, it wasn't in place of sidewalk, but as the sidewalk along Richmond and in other areas of the city. And that's been well received. It's been in for years. But we're looking at ways where to implement the Greenways plan, it's not all going to be a traditional off-road trail. It's not going to, and we want it to fit the neighborhood too and fit the context. And that's where, you know, doing the widened sidewalk achieves a lot of goals aesthetically. It looks very nice. It's very durable. And then it makes that connection.
There are a lot of apartments still over in this area too. Are you meeting only with the homeowners of the impacted lots, or are you meeting with all of the residents on the block?
Our goal, because of the way information flows anymore, is to meet with the northern side first. Yes. And those are all single family homes, some with multiple driveways. So our goal is to meet with everyone individually first, because we feel that's the best way to get the facts
and the right information.
Yes. And then the neighborhood meeting, which we'll do virtually.
Gotcha.
We will invite everyone from not only Lake, but really the whole neighborhood,
sure,
if you will. And that's where we will repeat the things we said when we met with the neighbors or the individuals.
And then
they say they want the same thing.
They very well may. And it was a conscious decision to go on the north side because.
More proximate.
Yes, exactly. More proximate because that's where the Edgewater connection is. And the parking is on the south side too. There was good engineering judgment and reason why.
Great that it fits.
Thanks a lot, Sean. That was a very. That ends our.
We need a motion to adjourn the meeting. So moved.
So adjourned. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.